guest today is Michael Girdley, chairman of Dura Software, which is a holding company focused on acquiring and operating niche software companies that operate mission-critical software for their end users. Michael also serves as the chairman of CodeUp, a full-stack web development and data analytics coding bootcamp located in San Antonio, Texas. He's the chairman of Alamo Fireworks, which is a multi-state retailer and wholesaler of fireworks, and as a venture partner at Geekdom Fund, a seed stage venture fund based out of San Antonio. I first came across Michael's content over Twitter and highly recommend his fresh take on all things software, small business, and life in general. Without further ado, Michael, welcome to the Circle of Competence podcast.
Yeah, super excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, just give us the 2-minute background on yourself leading up to today, if that's possible.
Yeah, so I'm a techie kid, grown up to be an entrepreneur. Came from a family of entrepreneurs. So, I describe to people, I've really gone through three phases of my career. So, left college with a computer science degree, decided that I was going to go get some experience by working for other people. So, moved out to the Bay Area, San Francisco area, and spent a good 5 or 6 years there working for other people, you know, climbed the corporate ladder a little bit. And then the second phase of my career was deciding to try to get into a leadership role in a small business. And the opportunity that presented itself was coming back to Texas. My wife and I wanted to move someplace warm. So we moved to San Antonio, came back and then had a handful of CEO jobs. The first one I got through nepotism. I happened to know the owner, my dad, who was ready to retire. So, was CEO of that business for just shy of 10 years. Started a couple other companies after that, one of which is CodeUp. And was CEO there as founding CEO. And then this third phase of my career is one where I spend the majority of my time in board roles. So working on companies rather than in them. So doing that through, a variety of vehicles, whether it's me personally or, through the fund, Geekdom Fund that we work on. All of those are kind of this model of being a investor and working at the meta level on companies.
That's great. And there are several topics in there that the common theme seems to be delegation and sort of replacing yourself, which I'd love to get into later. But I'm sure most folks are going to wonder, what got you from the tech business into the fireworks business? And then more broadly, what attracted you to small business in the first place? Yeah. Besides maybe the family connection?
Yeah. Well, the opportunity was, really for me to kind of cheat time, right? And I had finished up as a middle manager, director level person, at a big enterprise software company in the Bay Area. And, my father presented this opportunity to get involved in the family business and eventually take it over so he could, start being more comfortable in life, right? He was getting into his 60s and he deserved to live a less stressful existence. And the fireworks business is really stressful. Like, people don't realize how difficult it is. It's a hard business. And when I've gotten into other businesses, I look back on the fireworks business and it's like, wow, like, you mean people pay you every month in this other business? You mean people pay you beforehand? Like, all that stuff doesn't happen in the fireworks business because most of your revenue comes around the 4th of July, or in our case, the 4th of July and New Year's. So it was a great place for me to come and both learn from my dad and also from the School of Hard Knocks as, how hard business can be and how you have to step up as a leader to be able to succeed in a tough business.
That's really interesting. I'd be curious, what has happened to the fireworks business during COVID?
Yeah, so it's surprising. The 4th of July this past spring was perhaps one of the greatest fireworks selling seasons in history. It turns out, the competitors for fireworks are not what you think. The competitors are other forms of entertainment that are available. And it turns out if all of the other forms of entertainment that are available get made impossible, then the one that is legal, which was going out to a retail fireworks location and buying fireworks, was highly desirable. So, this past 4th of July, I've seen some busy seasons, when people come and buy fireworks. I'd never seen anything like what this 4th of July was like. It's just, everybody was just like, this sucks. We're trapped in our house. Let's go blow something up.
I love it.
It was pretty cool.
Well, congrats on a fantastic season. I want to hone in on something that you said that's around the concept of cyclicality. And it sounds like, you know, July 4th and sort of the end of the year, New Year's are part of that cyclicality. And if you miss or you have a snafu with supply chains, is that all of that all encompassing? Was that the reason why it was so stressful?
For sure. Well, and imagine you have a business where being 2 days late and having site development can mean you lose basically 6 months worth of revenue, right? And the rules somewhat are still the same, but it used to be even more complex in the state of Texas, where there were scenarios where you spend 6 months finding a new location. And we have about 200 or so of them at this point. And you go and you spend all this money to set up a new location, or even buying a piece of property to go put a fireworks stand on. And then some fire official shows up and says, hey, you're breaking the rules here. You need to close down. That kind of stuff, it's debilitating. You look at that, you look at the cash flow perspectives of the business, you look at the complexity of the supply chain, which is getting even more complex every year. The fact that a lot of people who are in the regulatory space, they don't like fireworks a lot of times, you know, because you're making a fire official work on the 4th of July. They want to be out at a barbecue. They'd rather be doing that than inspecting a fireworks stand or a store. And then the last thing, which is really interesting, is, you know, you talk about the OODA loops, the OODA loops that get used in the military, where you have these, basically you get data and you do your rapid decision loops. And that's how you become a high performing organization. Well, when your data gathering only happens every 6 months in our case, or in people who, you know, are just 4th of July only in the fireworks business, once a year. Like, imagine learning something on the July the 5th that you then have to wait 360 days to implement. Like, that creates some pretty long OODA loops and some pretty tough situations if you're trying to run a business well.
Wow. How do you underwrite? If someone wants to acquire a fireworks business, how would you underwrite that?
Look, I think there are different types of fireworks businesses. Underwriting a teeny tiny one is going to be different than underwriting one, you know, that's at scale. The ones at scale have some advantages, that you would expect. But you can start to look at the business from a holistic standpoint in terms of not having to worry about if a particular road gets shut down or there's a change in demographics or anything like that. But once you're at scale, you can start to see the professional ones are going to have appropriate P&L statements. They're going to have appropriate funding strategies, they're going to have appropriate go-to-market strategies, and you can start to underwrite those pretty well, just like you would any other business, by looking at a multi-year track record of what sort of profits they're able to generate, you know, how tax sheltered is that type of profit, and that sort of thing.
No, that makes sense. I have a couple more questions on Alamo before we move on to the tech side of things, but one of the biggest trends that I've noticed lately has been the explosion of search funds and searchers and young entrepreneurs who are just hungry to get their hands dirty and get into an operating role. Mm-hmm. Is getting into a small business for younger, hungry entrepreneurial types, is that something you would recommend? Why or why not?
I think I've been in a pretty particular corner of this stuff. Like, I don't think that people should be doing search funds straight out of business school. Like, I think it's really bad. To some extent, business school teaches you how to be a really good employee. I would encourage people either go apprentice with somebody who's run a business before, or go start something as a way to get yourself there. Like, I personally have never backed a search fund in the classical kind of MBAs and stuff like that. I don't think it's a good idea. I think it's too, I think you're missing just too much in terms of the basics, and you have too much in terms of the books, you know, the book knowledge, which can really hurt you. Now, that doesn't mean that somebody smart can't make it work, but like, I look at myself now, 15 or 20 years, you know, as a leader and manager in business. And I've made a lot of mistakes and learned a lot of stuff that I've read all of those MBA in a book books, you know, and audited classes at business school and stuff like that. And like, it doesn't prepare you for reality. And so look, it can work. It's worked for a lot of people. You know, the unfortunate reality is now that also search funding has gotten really popular. You're seeing a lot of people doing it. So that's pushing the prices up. And when you push the prices up, that reduces your margin of safety and you have less of an opportunity to learn on the job. So, you know, for me, I'm not a huge fan. It can work for other people, more power to them. But right now, it doesn't seem like the best path.
I would tend to agree just on a general level that if you see a lot of people sort of heading in the right direction, and one thing I've discovered is my initial reaction towards things like that at a more abstract level is to be a contrarian. I've just kind of discovered that, right or wrong. So I would tend to agree with that. But as they say,
yeah. Go ahead. It comes back to exactly what you're saying, right? Like, which is most people are great followers and are very scared to go do something that other people aren't. And, you know, you only get one shot at this life, in my humble opinion. And having worked at things that are easy and easy because other people aren't going after that same finite resource or competing with you, that is so much more fun to work on than situations in which there's 800 other searchers out there looking at the same exact type of business that you're looking at, where you have a lot of risk and you're going to be up, you know, at night trying to do that. And it's only because you were just too lazy to figure out and too scared to figure out how not to fish in the same pond with everybody else. Like, it's like, come on, people. That's how I feel about it.
I appreciate that. I'm going to ask you a question and we can circle back to it, because I want to give you some time to think about it. But because you hit on a topic that I really enjoy talking about, which is picking the ponds to fish in. Mm-hmm. So I'd be curious what ponds you would be fishing in, or already are fishing in, if you want to recommend that, or at least talk about some things that maybe you're not in that seem interesting to you from that perspective. But let's come back to that. Maybe I'll give you a little bit of time to mull over it.
Sure.
I want to switch gears to how you removed yourself as CEO from this company and what that process was like, how you went about hiring, and just what that process was like from a high level.
Yeah, look, and it's funny. There aren't a lot of books on like small business leadership transition stuff. So a lot of it is, I've just kind of had to figure out how to do that. I mean, I think when you're setting up a business for a transition like that is, are you as an owner/leader, right? The owner, operator, CEO, are you going to be mentally comfortable with letting go? So, you know, that's actually a bigger problem than the state of the business is, you know, most people, when they dig into it, realize, oh, like my personality is tied to this business, my sense of self-worth, what am I going to do all day? Like they oftentimes don't think about what sort of mental trauma they're going to go through and how they're going to spend their time when they suddenly get rid of a 60-hour work week job and have to trust somebody else or somebody else plus their team to run that for them. And so that's kind of the first step. Like, you have to set this foundation of how you do it, both changes for the business, but then changes for you. And then I think the kind of evolution there is, you know, you have to bring all the pieces together, right? You have to get good at hiring. You have to get good at defining roles. You have to get good at really understanding how the business should work and the processes are there. And once you have that, you know, you can run that playbook and really get in the right person. You know, and I think a lot of people complain that CEOs are overpaid or relative to other workers and stuff like that. But, you know, when you look at it from the side of just being somebody who is, you know, supervising the CEO, you realize how much impact that person really has in terms of directing the team and how good they can be. And then, you know, and then the last step is really defining how you're going to have your interaction model for the company. So what's your role going to be as the owner? Who's passive or semi-passive? What is the CEO's job going to be? And then you have to just be crazy diligent about doing that and maintain that interaction model. Early on, I had a ton of trouble with jumping in and solving problems for the CEO, when most times, unless it's an emergency, like I need to let them do their job and respect that. So there's really those three phases: pre, then you do it, and then you maintain, and all of them present unique challenges.
That's very interesting. And I've always loved the holding company model, a la Berkshire Hathaway, where Buffett really buys the business and is very hands-off because he's done his research up front. And from what I can tell, you're one of the few people that I've come across that have really put together like a playbook of what it looks like to both run a business, but then step outside of that business and hire somebody to replace that, mm-hmm. to replace that role. So I'd be curious, what do you look for in a CEO when you are replacing yourself and becoming the chairman?
Yeah, great question. I think what's really interesting is different businesses need different types of CEOs, right? So, you know, if I told you what the fireworks business needs, right, that's a business where the profits are made in the margins. So you need somebody that's comfortable with really grinding it out, like worrying about every single little detail, you know, and a type of person who can grow your EBITDA from 15% to 25%, but they're doing it 0.1 or 100 basis points, like per grind out. I'm not the right person to do that. Like, I don't like that kind of stuff. Creativity stuff, that's where I want to live. But grinding it out, that's not right. But you look at other businesses where they're still really defining their market. You know, Dura, where I'm partnered with an amazing CEO running the company there. Like, that's very much more of a creative, assemble the plane as you're flying it type situation. So you actually want a different personality type to match the company, right? How do you have the CEO company fit based on the natural traits and desires of the way that person operates? And then from then you can start to find, you know, is this a person who has a complementary operating style to you? Is this a person with shared values? Is this a person who is going to be acceptable to the culture of the team? All of those things are where you can kind of dig in there. But at its core, there's no single purpose CEO that fits for all of them.
And that you make some great points there about matching the CEO's capabilities and the personality to the needs of the business. When I think about your role between all of these business with Geekdom and CodeUp and Alamo and Dura, you know, being chairman in some capacity to each of these, what's your relationship like and the cadence of communication with the CEOs of those businesses, and what sort of problems do you guys solve together? Like, what does that communication and that back and forth look like?
Right. Yeah. So there's some stuff that's immutable. Like, it just has to work this way. So, you know, if I find if I'm going to be involved in multiple different things, I have to make sure that they're all speaking a similar language. So for example, we talked about the playbook of stuff, you know, if it's my decision, then we all are going to run EOS and we're going to use the other tools because, you know, then, you know, I know if we're using EOS, I know how the planning's done. I know that system in and out, and it helps me standardize that kind of stuff that's immutable and defined. And we just do it that way, right? And I don't have to worry about how they're going to do visioneering or strategy or team building. Like, I just know what the answers are. And we can define that directly to their particular business situation rather than figuring out what system we're going to use. And so there's that bucket of stuff. And then, you know, what I do is I define an interaction model that makes sense depending upon what the company needs. So that can be a combination of, you know, scheduled one-on-one times, board meetings done at an appropriate cadence, a reporting structure that makes sense. All of those things are then kind of put into a regular cadence and hopefully solving the right stuff. And then the layer below that is in those meetings, each company will need different things based on what their challenges are. And for me, you know, I can be most helpful as the guy behind the guy, helping these businesses grow and sometimes think about stuff differently and challenge when appropriately, but also just being there for them to help them, you know, be engaged to solve the problems, right? I don't know if I'm describing that well, but it's kind of this balance of, it's like very much a coaching kind of mindset, right? And customizing that based on what the company needs and the CEO needs and who they are and where they're coming from and what they're going through and all that stuff.
No, that's great. I want to hit on two sort of themes there. One is coaching and the second is systems. the first coaching, what is your weekly, do you have a typical weekly schedule that those coaching occurrences happen? Is it not so typical? I'd be curious about that. And then would love to also talk about the systems and the playbook that you mentioned.
Yeah, look, I got coached to say look less. So if you hear me do it, point it out, because it's a bad rhetorical device that's diminutive. So I'm trying not to do it. So I've said it twice so far. So I'm calling myself out. If you hear me say look, tell me. But anyway, I do best when there is a regular cadence, and especially with CEOs, you know, setting up that time, whether it's weekly or every other week, to spend time with them is hugely valuable. And it's a forcing function around that. So I've learned things won't just happen because I'm an introverted guy and my default is to be alone and be happy about it. So I have to schedule that stuff around those type of things to make it really work. And then there was a second part of your question, but I think I only answered the first part.
So the first was coaching and the cadence, and that's great. Weekly occurrences and interactions with the CEOs and leadership of the companies. Mm-hmm. Second was the systems. And you mentioned the playbook, which I would love to link to in the show notes. I've taken a look at it. I have admittedly not read all of the books, but I have them in my Amazon shopping cart and would like to go check them all out. But I just want to give you an opportunity to chat about that, how you came up with it, and what that looks like for a company to implement that, maybe post-close or over time.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so the story was after working on multiple businesses and helping them, you know, I just got tired of doing the same things over and over again differently, right? And every business has to hire people. Every business has to do planning. Every business has to do coordination. Every business has to measure their employee engagement. All that kind of stuff happens no matter whether you're a tech company or a fireworks company or a big one or a small one. And I reached a breaking point at one juncture when, you know, I had a couple of bad hires and they didn't work out. And it was mostly because I didn't run a good process. I didn't have one. And a person told me once, like, you know, having no process is a process. You just have a bad one that you haven't thought through. So I spent about 2 years just going through all of those common challenges that I talked about and looked at a whole spread of different systems out there. So everything from how you do strategic planning, how you run your weekly meetings, how do you, you know, run good hiring processes, how do you quantify people, all that kind of stuff in terms of thinking about how to run businesses better. Because at a certain point, none of those are unique problems to you or me running a business. Somebody has thought through how to do those things. And so I ended up starting to assemble these things, right? I found EOS for business planning and visioneering. I found a tool called Culture Index for, you know, basically doing personality assessments and understanding those traits that we talked about before. NPS for customer satisfaction. Just started to assemble all those things. And I looked up at one point and I had about 10 different things that, you know, I was using everywhere and realized together, this was just a playbook that everybody should use when they're running a small business. And so that's what I put together. It's nothing I make any money off of. I just call it a playbook. I wrote a white paper about it and put it on my website. And those are things that, you know, I use to standardize operations across every venture of every size.
And I will go ahead and promote it. It's really cool. It will take some time to read through the books and even more time to implement it. You know, if you're a small business owner, but highly recommend it. I'll link to it in the show notes. I want to change gears away from systems and more towards some of your career and your background. One of the reasons why I was excited to get you on the podcast was because this podcast is focused on both on people who sort of sit in the middle of entrepreneurial and operator roles and capital allocation roles as well. And you are unique in that you've done both and you continue to sort of do both and coach, but also allocate capital. So I want to hear the story behind Coda, what that was like building that business, but then also we can hit Geekdom as well and some of your experiences there. So maybe just give a 2-minute background on Coda and what that was like, the process, where things are today and where you're headed there.
Yeah. It's a great business. It's it's a fun one because it's one of those ones that's a rare thing that you can both do okay financially, but then have a real impact on helping people's lives be better. Like, and not in a BS kind of way, right? It's for real. Like it's changing people's lives and helping them, you know, turn into the types of folks they want to be, right? We're a Yoda for them on that journey to become the Jedi that they want to be. So, you know, back in late 2012, and that's 8 years ago now, I was spending a lot of time around an entrepreneurial co-working space that we have in San Antonio designed to help people start tech companies. And I had met a couple guys there. And then we saw a couple different things came together, right? And this, you'll see this in kind of the brand of entrepreneurship I practice, like, and some professors have named it, we could talk about, it's called effectual entrepreneurship. And so basically, like, this brand of entrepreneurship that I do tends to tie together observations from other people and things from around the world that you see, and then assembles those into something that is a business on top of that. So CodeUp was kind of the first one of those effectual kind of experiments, right? And it turned out really well, where I saw that a lot of startups and companies in San Antonio couldn't hire developers. So had that data point, saw that there was a hunger for people in San Antonio to better themselves and to get better jobs. And then lastly, we saw that this model of basically coding boot camps was taking off in other markets. So, you know, we went and looked at websites for the 7 or 8 of those that existed at the time. There's since become hundreds around the country, but there were several there. We took the things that we liked and didn't like, and we said, okay, well, let's do this here. And some of the stuff, like, we just innovated a little bit and said, we're going to fix this. So, for example, one of the other coding boot camps had a money back guarantee, which was like, if you don't get a job, we'll give you back half your money. And we said, well, that's not good enough. And eventually we got to where we are now, which is, if you don't get a job, we give you back all your money, which is hugely powerful and directly aligns to our interests with the students' interests, which is, they're not there for an education. They're there for a life change. So we have a CEO running the business. It's one of the co-founders, team of about 50 people now, running classes in Dallas and San Antonio, big placement arm, bringing through a few hundred students a year, and really offering kind of a higher quality thing than, you know, some other folks are doing. So it's been great, really, really great.
Yeah, I have noticed that in a lot of these coding boot camps that, you know, it's probably easy to just go all remote, just like, you know, kind of like the Lambda schools with either full stack web development or data analytics. I'd be curious if there are other sort of sub verticals in the coding boot camp space that you guys are interested in looking at and maybe adding later on, because I think full stack web development is in demand. Obviously, data analytics is very much in demand. But are there any other areas that you all are exploring?
Yeah. Well, yeah, the two big ones are what you said, web and data science, which we do today. There's a DevOps and systems administration, which I think is pretty popular. That's there in the tech stuff as well. I think there's front end web development, which is interesting and appealing for certain reasons. And we could talk about that if you want. And then, you know, I do think there's other things to kind of dig into, but those are the top two kind of, I would see as opportunities for, you know, on the coding tech side of stuff.
Where do you see the coding boot camps, sort of that market going? Obviously it's very nascent back in 2012. It's a little bit more mature now. I'd be curious kind of your thoughts on where that's headed.
Yeah. Look, I think, I did the look thing again. Didn't I do that? Sorry. Okay. That's three coins in the swear jar. Yeah. I'm out. Yeah. I think there is going to continue to be a stratification of the market. You know, we were very intentional building CodeUp that some of our competitors went down the University of Phoenix route, and we said we would rather try to be Harvard. Harvard is a much longer grind than the University of Phoenix route, and that's okay. we're fine with that. That means we couldn't grow as quickly as other folks. The people that went down the University of Phoenix route and grew really quickly, it's really super easy to get out over your skis and disappear. But you're seeing a stratification of that. So for example, if you see that there's like the university provided boot camps in their extensions, those actually aren't provided by the university. Those aren't university staff or anything like that. They're third party kind of semi scammy companies running quick hit, give us $8,000, you know, and high buy type thing. So you're seeing the stratification around that, just like any other kind of higher ed stuff has happened. You know, I do think there's also a real challenge that's going to happen around making sure some of these companies get long-term financed and what that means for the students. We have intentionally stayed away from the ISA model. We think it's one of those things that actually looks like it aligns interests, but it doesn't really. And you can see that in the numbers, like the ISA boot camps. That, you know, are you familiar with ISAs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Where you're agreeing to, so an ISA is an income sharing agreement where you're agreeing to, for those of you who don't know what an ISA is, you're agreeing to share a percentage of your future income with the education entity.
Right. Yeah. And we think that that's one of those things that actually doesn't align incentives as much as you would think it is. You're like, oh, if you don't get a job, you don't have to pay. Well, the problem with that is it creates a perverse incentive for the school. Right? Because imagine you're a school and you have 100 people that you bring in and only 50 look like they're really, really good. 30 look like you're going to have to do some work and 20 looks like you're going to have to do a lot of work to get them a job. Where are you going to spend your time?
That's a great point.
Who are you going to encourage to drop out? Who are you going to really bet on? And you see it, like the ISA-based schools have done generally two things. They've either gone out of business or they've had to raise a ton of money to stay there. And they all have these ridiculous dropout rates. Like the dropout rate of some of the big ones is 15 or 20% in the first month.
Wow.
Yeah. So, wow. So those interests don't really align. You know, I think what CodeUp is doing, which says, look, we're going to give you back your money if you don't get results, but also we're not going to give up on you, is hugely valuable, right? I would much rather sign up for that as a person than some school that's like, well, if you're good, we're going to love you. But if you suck, good luck.
Right? Too bad.
Yeah.
Well, you raise a few good points there. And one of them, and you've said this earlier, is you only have one life. For a company, you can create a company, give away equity if you want in exchange for financing, go out of business, create another company. But if you give away equity in yourself, that's kind of the way that I've thought about it is I just don't know that I would be able to, I'd be willing to do that. That's a greater debt than taking on actual debt. Yeah. In my opinion.
Yeah.
So you raise a really good point there. Obviously, Michael's thought a lot about this from an entrepreneurial perspective. Let's kind of change gears to Geekdom, the early stage, seed stage fund. And then also, I would like you to maybe compare that with what you're looking at with Dura. And then we can go from there.
Yeah. Well, so Geekdom Fund is actually the name of the co-working space I mentioned before, the entrepreneurial co-working space, is based out of Geekdom. It's called Geekdom, and it's founded by the gentleman, Graham Weston, who started Rackspace with one of the co-founders.
Oh, fantastic.
A handful of other folks as well. And they're all great people. And so, you know, I think what we've done with these ventures, a lot of them coming out of Geekdom, are what he wanted to have happen, which is let me put the entrepreneurial minded tech people in San Antonio who are previously spread out amongst all the suburbs, let's put them in one place and see what happens. And the idea that the Petri dish would, you know, cause higher order life forms to emerge, which totally was a good bet. But Geekdom Fund is named after that co-working space. They're very kind to let us use the name. We're independent. It is myself and three other partners who, you know, started in 2013, you know, raising some venture capital funds that are still active. We're on our third fund and have a bit over $50 million under management. and use that as a way to invest really at that early stage life cycle of software companies. So if you think about software and kind of high growth internet tech companies, you know, potentially they go through this big growth curve and they keep going all the way to the moon, which we've had a couple on the right trajectory to get there. But some of them go like this, right? Our bootstrap companies go like this. And when I say this, I mean like down and, you know, towards the end of their life cycle and people are ready to make a change. And so really where Geekdom Fund and Dura play are at the either ends of that life cycle. So Geekdom Fund invests in companies on their way up and helps them, you know, maximize the opportunity to be a rocket ship. Dura Software is a place where, you know, long in the tooth, software companies of a certain size can make a transition to a new set of owners who are going to love them and hold them forever. And that's really where those two different things play. And they're structured differently, different leadership, different everything between Geekdom Fund and Dura.
Right. Before we get into Dura, that'll be our sort of our last section of the interview. But I just want to talk a little bit about some of the investments that have done, you know, really well for Geekdom and maybe some of the trends that you've noticed where they have hit that J curve and they've just absolutely taken off. Was your thesis proved correct? Was it something else entirely? What themes have you noticed among those companies that have really done extremely well?
Yeah, the ones that do well tend to check all the boxes. And there's interesting lenses where people think about venture. There's the people who think if we get the team right, everything will be okay. They'll figure everything out. There's another one where it's like, if we get the market and opportunity right, we'll figure everything out. And then there's a third group that's like, okay, well, let's bet on hard tech stuff. And if we get the tech figured out, everything will be all right. And the reality is, like, I think there's a fourth bucket of the way people think about venture, which is you have to check all of those boxes for a company really to go right. There are so many ways for a company to go wrong, but so few relatively ways for a company to go right. And so, you know, the ones we've seen that have really taken off have been in the right market space with the right timing. They've provided the right technology and right solution to it. And at the core, there's been a team that has just been amazing in the ability to do those kind of what we talked about, OODA loops, really, really quickly and make the right decisions over and over again. And the ones that break out, check all those boxes and really make that happen. So that's the ones, the pattern that I've seen, right? Which is cool, but also pretty rare.
That to me sounds a little bit like the Anna Karenina principle, where all happy families are happy in the same way, but all unhappy families are unhappy in different ways. Oh, yeah. So is that the case in early stage ventures as well?
For sure. Yeah, it's exactly right. So it's so rare that all those boxes get checked. The painful thing about it is there's a lot of luck involved also, where I think the entrepreneurs who are very mindful, who have gone through it and been successful, realize how fortunate they've been, not just during the venture, but also before that, right? Like getting exposed to the right people, having the right network, getting lucky with your first job, all that stuff is path dependent things that makes a huge outcome in terms of what's going to happen when you start your startup, or even if anybody's going to give you money to invest in it. So I love a lot of the really experienced entrepreneurs who realize that luck is really underrated in terms of what happens with all this stuff. And that brings a level of humility to them. You know, even if they're worth $200 million and fly private jets, you know, they're like, I got lucky, right? I always admire that.
Right time, right place, right people. Mm-hmm. The Bessemer Ventures just put out a few memos. Of course, they were very much selective memos of some of their most successful ventures. I'm not sure if you've been able to take a look at them, but it's interesting how they probability weight some of their investments to sort of project what they think will be sort of the expected outcome. On an ex ante basis, when you look at some of your successes, were those the ones that you were most sure about, or were you surprised after the fact?
Yeah, it's interesting. Most people think about venture as a very binary thing. Done right, venture is very much an increasing conviction thing, right? Where, say, pre-seed, you put in a certain amount of money. Seed, you put in more money. A, you put in more money. Series B, you're like pulling nickels out of the couch cushions. to increase your conviction around that stuff as much as you can, or preempting some of those things to try to own as much of a rocket ship as you possibly can. So, you know, I think the question is interesting, but also it's kind of ties back to this ideas of entrepreneurship that I have, which is, you know, it's not a one hit swing for the fences kind of thing. It's actually much more of, you know, placing little bets and increasing conviction over time as more data and confirmation of your hypothesis comes in. So looking back on it, maybe, you know, there's also the flawed nature of human memory and why it's good to do those deal memos, because 3 years later, if you don't do a deal memo, you're going to remember how you felt about that deal much differently than probably really happened.
Right, right. Having a clear reality of what you were thinking at the time is very important. Chamath, and I'm hoping I'm saying his last name right, Palihapitiya, I think is his last name.
Palihapitiya?
Chamath. We'll refer to him as Chamath on the show, yeah. Because we're besties.
We're buddies.
He tweeted something very similar to what you just said, which is slugging percentage is what matters in investing. Mm-hmm. And but to your earlier point, to place many little bets, but then when you find something that you have high conviction in, to continue doubling down, because it's not the number of successes, the number of base hits that you get, it's the home runs that have the sort of outsized results for a career over time, especially when you're talking about compounding, not a linear process, but an exponential process. So I think that's totally spot on, and I'll try and link to that tweet. I thought it was a really good tweet. I retweeted it. So I want to move on to the last section, Dura. And Dura, you are buying these niche software companies, very different model than investing in earlier stage companies. So I want to hear, how do you have sort of a mental framework, the mental models. We've gone over the mental model for early stage companies. I want to hear the mental model for these operating companies that you're buying in Dura, and how you think about those, because obviously you're not investing in those small amounts and hoping that they sort of go to the moon. They are operating businesses that you hope to cash flow and then sort of redeploy that capital, right? So just talk a little bit about that and maybe the different mental model that you use there.
Yeah. Well, I think the core of what Dura does is there was a core observation that we had that there are a lot of software companies out there. There are a ton that are too small for private equity, growing too slowly for venture capital, and too big for somebody to buy themselves a job. And based on that, we really had the fundamental model that, you know, like we talked about before, fishing in ponds where other people are not fishing is much more interesting, and structured ourselves differently to be able to capitalize on that. So that's one of the interesting challenges about search funds. If you go look at the way like search funds and software are underwriting deals, like they are basically just like fixing 40% compounding annual growth in their model and saying, we're going to do it. Well, that's great. Unless you're in a mature market that, you know, it's pretty much impossible for you to do that organically. So it creates a really interesting deal there. But, you know, I think there's this element of, you know, how do you identify an opportunity, but then how do you structure yourself appropriately for it, you know, that we did with this holding company model, which is not a fund, because you couldn't buy the assets we're buying if you were a fund. It just doesn't, the economics just don't work.
I want to dig into the structure. You've hit on that a couple times, but I want to make sure if you're open to sharing at least high level details.
Yeah, Dura is a C corporation. Pretty straightforward. Has a CEO and board and people that work there.
Versus a traditional private equity fund that has a term on it and a period of deploying the capital and a period of sort of operating and then a period of harvesting those capital gains. Is that just high level different?
Correct. So like they'll run like a 2-in-20 model or a 1.5-in-20 model or 1-in-30, you know, in terms of management fee versus carry. We don't do that because it just doesn't make sense, right? We have a permanent hold model. So like, well, how do we liquidate that stuff? Like we don't do it. There's also huge tax advantages these days for being a corporation over being a fund. So while fund does do long-term capital gains and that sort of thing, there are exemptions that happen, you know, with QSBS and certain other things that you can take advantage of as an operating company, plus depreciation, all that kind of stuff. Things have skewed with the 2018 tax cut and revision to where, you know, it's definitely better in some regards to be a C corp, and hopefully those changes stay to where we get rid of things like double taxation on dividends and stuff like that.
Right, right. All makes sense. Now, you guys have you done three deals so far?
We have done three acquisitions that are public, three that are in process, and one that we haven't announced.
So, oh, fantastic. Yeah. Now, those three that are you haven't announced, closed?
One has closed, two haven't.
Okay. Were those all during COVID?
I think both. One was signed LOI. The one that we finished, we signed the LOI pre-COVID. The other two signed post-COVID, I think.
Very interesting.
Everything remotely.
I was just about to go there. So due diligence, everything remote. Wow.
Yeah, that crazy. Is
very interesting. My father-in-law and I were just chatting last night about, I feel like people want to hop on a plane and come and go and see people. I would be curious about what you think that process has been like, due diligence in a company totally remote. Would you have done it in person if kind of, will you, I guess the better question is, will you go back and do something in person now that you've done a couple companies remotely?
Yeah. There will be components of it that, and I think this is universal for everybody, there will be components of it that don't go back to in person. There will be components of it that definitely do go back.
So, like what components?
I think most importantly are a lot of the things that don't communicate well in Zoom. Cultural fit is one. And the little things, right? We went and looked at a company once and we're in the room talking to a potential future teammate, and we walk out and it's like 3 o'clock on a Tuesday. And I'm like, where the hell is everybody? Like, where'd they go? Like, and I was like, where is everybody? And I asked the person, they're like, oh, everybody leaves at 3 o'clock on Tuesday. I'm like, what? Everybody leaves at 3 o'clock on Tuesday? Like, and look, I'm not like a drill sergeant person in terms of managing that stuff and expecting people to kill themselves. But like, how about we stay until dinner time? You know, 5 o'clock, 9 to 5, anything?
Yeah, what are we doing? What are we doing between 3 and 5?
So, you know, those little things, and people say so much that they don't say, those little things tell you so much about the culture and the character of the people that you're going to get when you merge in with another company. So I think that is a great example of one that tells you things that you're not going to get. Because if you ask somebody that runs a company like that, they undoubtedly would tell you that we're a hardworking group of people and like stuff.
It's all relative until you sort of get in person and you get to observe based on your own metrics and your own yardsticks, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And don't get me wrong, I'm not a grind them into the ground type of person, but like nothing happens unless you do some work.
No, that's interesting. I have heard of several people saying that, you know, they've done due diligence on companies totally remote. I work in the real estate industry, and I think a lot of the data that you need, you can do a lot of that remotely. You may have to hop on a flight to go diligence. You're going to want to do that, you know, in person probably once, but I hear what you're saying, that multiple times may never come back. So yeah, I'd be curious if there are any other sort of trends that you've noticed post-COVID, maybe across the businesses that you work in, Geekdom or Dura, that have been interesting and may change permanently post-COVID.
Sure. I think you're seeing these business processes change permanently. Like we talked to an investor the other day, and he said that he's telling all of his companies that their 2021-22 on budget should reduce their travel, their T&E expenses by 75%. That's their new baseline. And it's kind of smart, right? Because it basically forces you as a company to figure out what's really essential from a T&E standpoint. And
what's a priority?
Yeah. And so much of what we've done historically has been inertia, wise, right? It's a holdover from the days of fax machines and telephones. And in particular, one of our fund companies that I spent a lot of time with had to go and reset everything in terms of their sales process. And they do a home-based equipment, you know, business called Trexo out of Toronto. They do basically exoskeletons for kids who are wheelchair bound. Great business. And basically they had to reset their entire onboarding and sales process to be done remotely. Like, there's no way they're going to go back to flying people to Bentonville, Arkansas to install some kid's device anymore from Toronto. They're just going to do it all remotely via FaceTime. And it works even better and it's cheaper and it helps gross margins. Like, that stuff's not going back, not at all. And so I think there will be that reverberation of this stuff, but some of the stuff will definitely come back. Like, the person who puts their butt in the seat and flies out to you know, do the deal, like, that really helps, right? In person, you get a lot more yeses than via voice.
No, that makes sense. That was sort of my point when I was chatting last night, is that I think as you see other people going to your competitors to get the deal, you yourself are going to want to be in person as well. But from an internal business standpoint, a lot of those processes, like you just mentioned, could indeed be remote. Mm-hmm. Between customers. So I think you make a great point sort of differentiating the external versus the internal processes. That's a really good way to think about it.
For sure.
I'd be curious what your thought process is, or your thought process is with big cities, like the big cities that are quote unquote dead now after COVID because of bandwidth and just cost of living. I'm curious what your thoughts are there. This is a hot topic.
Oh yeah. I think that's totally wrong. Like, I think anybody declaring the end of New York is crazy. Like, they're just so, that is so wrong. Right. Because, like, fundamentally, it also demonstrates, if you think those cities are dead, it demonstrates a misunderstanding of what really drives human beings. And every 22-year-old I know is full of hormones, and they want to go where the greatest mating opportunities are, and that ain't happening in Mobile, Alabama. Like, seriously, I mean, it's just.
I've been to Mobile. It's a pretty place.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful, but the dating market is not the New York City dating market.
Very true.
Right. And, you know, I think anybody who thinks that those are going to be, those are going to be changing, they're crazy. If you're a real estate investor, go buy a big city. I'll tell you right now, just go buy it. If you can find something on sale, go buy it. It's coming back.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sort of a proponent of the great moderation. So if the cost of living in some of these cities will probably drop sort of in the medium term, but I agree long term, you know, humans want to be close to those amenities, not just the dating markets, but also jobs. And my thought process is there's a moderation there, but it won't be total decimation. Mm-hmm. I guess is a way to, I'm hoping that, you know, areas like Raleigh Durham where I am based, will be sort of a beneficiary on the margin of people who are already sort of thinking about getting out of the big cities, have a lower cost of living, high relative, you know, level of education where you can find a good workforce, you know, et cetera. Not unlike San Antonio and some of the Texas markets. Mm-hmm. So, no, I think I'm definitely on board with your views there. Well, I want to wrap up. I've got a few final questions that I ask most of my guests, and so we'll run through those and then we'll wrap it up. What personal values or beliefs are most important to you, and how do they inform your day-to-day business?
Personally, so yeah, I prepped this question because these are the things, like,
you never want to be unprepared for.
Yeah, it's like, let me say, well, you know, you'd be like, like, I don't know. Well, if, you know, like, the reason podcasts like this are relatively easy, because A, everybody likes talking about themselves, and B, everybody's an expert on it. So it's like, okay, well, good. So you seem like a real jerk if you don't know how to answer the, tell me what you think about whatever. So, look, I think when I thought about I did the look thing, didn't I? I'm a terrible person.
Only four times. That's not terrible in an hour.
Okay, what personal values or beliefs? I think the unique thing is a lot of the people I work with have this desire for control and limelight some combination of those two things. Like, I think I'm entirely happy to see success by supporting other people's success. So when I, you know, get involved in things or start them, I'm totally fine with somebody being like, okay, well, you're going to be in charge, or me not being in charge. Like, I don't need the glory myself. I'm crazy happy if something happens without me having to do the work or be the guy, because that means I free up to achieve other stuff. So yeah, I think that's unique. I think it's also essential to this model. I see a lot of people that try to do semi-passive or totally passive stuff that just can't let go. And it's really hard.
That is great advice, because it sort of wraps in this idea of valuing your freedom of time and also putting the light on someone else. So I like that a lot. I like that a lot. That's one we haven't gotten yet. What advice would you give yourself before starting out as an entrepreneur and investor?
Yeah, for sure. I think as a younger person, I put too much value on what other people thought. And because of that, was really worried about how failure would reflect on me. The reality is that the things that I have that look like wins now, there's two or three dead bodies besides each of them of things that just went nowhere. And I think that over time I've, you know, learned to be okay with failure and things not turning out well. And that's just part of the journey. And that's always easier once you have a couple wins to have a couple L's. But it is for sure something I suffered in my 20s with.
Yeah, handling failure is certainly a characteristic of resilient people.
Yeah,
I love that. What's one person you would like to meet who is alive today, and what would you want to talk about?
I wrote down two people for this. One of them I think is an impossible answer, but I would want to hang out with Charlie Munger, but 30 years ago. Like, no offense to Charlie's 97 or whatever. I know no 97-year-olds that are really, you know, as crisp as I would hope in their thinking, but Charlie Munger in his 60s or 70s would have been awesome to spend time with. Number two would be Mark Leonard. So Constellation Mark Leonard. Like, I want to see what that beard looks like in real life.
I love it. I love it. I'm a huge fan of, and I'll try and link to these in the show notes. I'll link to the Mark Leonard letters, but they are some of my favorite, just crisp, well-written letters that focus on just high-level, most important KPIs. And they're just fantastic. I'll link to them. They're some of my favorite annual letters, right up there with Berkshire Hathaway. And to your point about Munger, I wish I could talk to him right after he gave the speech about human psychology, of the biases speech, the famous speech. That guy is incredibly smart. We'll just leave it at that. So I love that answer. What's the biggest challenge personally or professionally for you right now?
I think it's interesting, because this model that I have personally of being involved in a lot of things is pretty foreign and pretty unique. There are a lot more books on how to be a small business CEO than books on how to not be a small business CEO. So I think that's both fun, challenging, and a bit scary, because like in my CEO peer group, I'm the only one doing what I'm doing. Like everybody else is owner operator of their company, and everybody else looks at me like I'm an alien, because a little bit I am. And I'm okay with that, but it's also a big challenge, because some of the things, like we talked about the evolution of how to hire people or how to think about, you know, interfacing with a company as a small business person passively, a lot of it's still just a continual experiment. Like, it can still go horribly wrong. It's been going right for 6 years now, but it still could go horribly wrong. So it's a great challenge and also a little scary.
That's awesome. And I hear you. It's doesn't sound very challenging, though. I have to admit, the freedom of time that I'm hearing about right now is pretty awesome. So that's cool.
I'm really busy. I work a lot. my son wrote it, you know, I think a lot of parenting is people think it's about what you tell your kids. I think so much more of it is about what you do around your kids. And my 9-year-old at the time wrote an essay for school, and three times in it, he mentioned, my dad works really hard. My dad. And he just kept saying that. And I was like, you know, hopefully I'm demonstrating for them that hard work is what it takes, right? Hard work and grit is how you get ahead. And all these people that are like, you don't have to work very hard, like take it easy. Like that's bull crap.
I agree. And but I think I would insert here though, that you've done two things. You've worked hard and you've worked very, very smart. And you've used a lot of different forms of leverage with labor and capital and code that, you know, Naval talks all the time about. And when I think you get those two things in combination, it's, to use Munger's word, a Lollapalooza effect, right?
Yeah.
So I agree with you there.
My brother and I call that being strategically lazy. Like, how do you achieve the thing with the optimal or minimal amount of effort? I think it's me and my brother, we're pretty lazy people.
I love it. Work hard and smart is the message here, and use leverage.
Yeah, for sure.
I just want to give you, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes to just chat about and sort of get your message out about Dura and your podcast that you run. You know, I like to highlight, similar to what you like to do, get, you know, shine the light on other people and what they're working on. So I just want to give you a chance to get your message out about some of the things that you're working on and how people, if they're interested, can get in touch with you to work with you and what that would look like.
Yeah, great. Yeah, thanks. So, you know, Dura, we're a software holding company. If you know somebody with a small software business that wants to exit it, especially to a place that is going to, you know, really respect their legacy and hold it permanently and do all the things that are going to come with that in terms of respecting the thing you've spent a lot of your life building, we'd love to talk to them. You know, we typically play in the 2 to 5 million annual revenue software businesses. So Dura.software is the website for that. It's a good business built by really good people. I mean, I joke around a lot that it is the nicest group of people I've ever worked with. And I've worked with a lot of really nice Boy Scout oriented organizations, and it's pretty great there. So personal website is mylastname.com. So I blog there occasionally, though I'm spending a lot more time on Twitter. And I'm M. Girdley on Twitter. So I am enjoying the video game that Twitter has become for me since COVID started. So, and it caused us to meet, which is fantastic and such a huge benefit of that platform.
Fantastic. I will link to all of those in the show notes. So, because as I said earlier, my hope is that I can provide value for the people that want to come on and share their wisdom and experiences. So Michael, thanks so much for coming on today. And I look forward to keeping in touch. Best of luck.
Yeah, buddy. Thanks, Benton.
This is Benton here again. Thanks so much for listening to the Circle of Competence podcast. To find more episodes like this one, go to circleofcompetence.co. That's circleofcompetence.co to sign up for my weekly podcast emails, as well as a monthly summary of links to blog posts and articles I liked most from the previous month. Finally, if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a rating on iTunes, which will help more people discover the work we are doing to explore the entrepreneurial investor's journey. Thanks again for listening.